This podcast is in partnership with Design Biennale Rotterdam, Phoenix Museum, Lack of Guidance, Margreet Olsthoorn, New Institute and Rotterdam Partners, as they all share the common goal to create awareness, share opinions and empower creative growth.
I think this is the most important lesson I can teach people is get comfortable with feeling uncomfortable. And I think art can help a lot with that. The basics is, are you treated as a human?
It sounds very logical and very basic, but in lots of places where I come, it's not there.
You challenge the status quo, you are shaking up the system, and that system gives a lot of people stability, comfort, and security. So the resistance you get is not something personal.
In today's episode, I'm joined by Simone van Neerven. With nearly 20 years in corporate giants like KLM and Vueling, Simone has made a career out of questioning norms, breaking and optimizing outdated systems, and helping organizations unlock their most unconventional talent. We dive into the risks she took to build her own path, why real innovation starts with discomfort, and how she learned to navigate resistance and uses the power of curiosity over passion. Welcome, Simone van Neerven.
Thanks for the invite.
We're going to talk about rebels.
I thought I have this podcast for the creative industry and this mission you're on. I think wherever you work, live, let's talk about it because this is super interesting and so valuable for every person who is challenging themselves, the environment, leadership. Let's talk about where are we, for instance.
Today we are in Think School of Creative Leadership. And I think we'll talk about it later, but this really changed my life. Yeah, so we're one of the rooms. Maybe I can describe a little bit like what we are and what we are looking at. So Think Home is in the middle of Amsterdam city center and it's next to the zoo, Artis. So if we look out of the window, we see the zoo and we see the tapirs walking around. And someone just whispered, there's also an ant eater.
So if we hear them, then everyone knows.
Yeah, so we might hear some birds or other animals.
How's life treating you at the moment?
Pretty well, actually. Well, you look at me, everybody says, oh, you have such a tan face. Well, that's because I have a really nice balcony, lots of plants, and I like to sit there together with my little cat, Basje. I feel pretty nice, pretty relaxed, and I'm in a good spot.
Are you in a place in your career that you are quite happy that you found it or still searching?
It's a good question because I reflected on this the other day. I was talking to someone and I said, there is a saying about every 7-8 years you get the itch, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm in the middle of it.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm here 7-8 years ago. I did think it really changed my life. So then I counted back and 7 years before that, I was still working at KLM, corporate career, but something happened, so I made a radical decision in my career. It was also about 7 years prior to that. The 7 years prior to that was actually the start of after graduating to working life. So it sort of like makes sense, the 7 years. And now I'm in the middle of, oh my God. Yeah, so I feel good, but also I feel very anxious.
Is this also a tip for people who are listening, trying to find themselves or who are maybe a little bit lost to look back, count the years up to 7 and say like, hey, maybe this is quite normal that you have this moment? Or is it something you personally take on?
No, I wouldn't do it that dogmatic. Hmm. And for me, it was also like I reflected back and I'm like, 7 years or 8 or something like that. What I would say is that I think it's quite normal to feel a little bit ambiguous, right? So at least for me, I notice when I start to get things under control and I started to get sort of like that everything is becoming really comfortable. And I think something inside happens that I need to find a place where it's less comfortable.
Yeah.
And I think so for people, think this is life, right? So I think it's good that if you are in a place where you don't feel comfortable, that's also a spot where you learn. So embrace that. Don't run away from it. Don't get addicted or whatever, but try to embrace and find ways to deal with it.
Can you maybe explain a little bit how you do this? Because being inside the comfort zone, stepping out, there are so many gurus who explain this, but how do you actually do it? And especially like a rebel who always wants to push and etc.
Yeah, I confront people or I provoke sometimes just to provoke, right? Not because it's my opinion or whatever, but to make some people uncomfortable. It's not because I wanna be a pain in the ass or whatever, but I want to make them think. How do I deal with that uncomfortable feeling? I don't know, actually. I sport a lot. I've always done that. I walk a lot, follow my curiosity. And I think that also learns me to deal with uncertainty, right? Because if you are curious, you figure out or you find things that you don't know about. So if you lean into that and you deep dive into that, well, you start to learn new things. So I think that those are mechanisms I do to deal with it. But it's not that I'm going to sit and say, okay, now I have to deal with this. These are routines that I've learned or ways to...
Yeah.
That I've incorporated in my life, yeah.
And you mentioned that think where we are right now. You mentioned twice already that it changed your life.
Yes.
Now that you're a couple of years ahead from the moment that it actually happened, you're now maybe more in a comfort zone and you could show me the building and that you loved it.
Yeah.
Is it now a moment to move on?
I think I will always be moving on. So it's not that I sit still and move on. So think. I was maybe reflect a little bit on how I ended up here. So I graduated. It was a time where it was cool to join a corporate, which is maybe different today. So I didn't think about it a lot. I first went to Post, like the Dutch mail. It was fun. But after almost 2 years, I decided to leave and went to KLM. And I did a lot of different jobs in KLM. But after 16 years or so, I got really stuck. Mm. Really stuck. I don't call it a burnout, but I was just stuck. So I had done a lot of cool stuff, lots of resistance. And I was like, okay, what do I do now? So one of my friends told me about Think. Briefly, she said, oh, there's something here. And the building was at one of the canals. And she said, oh, maybe you should just walk in and then see. And I was like, okay. So I walked in and I was like, okay, let's go for it. So I joined the program 2 weeks before the start. So it was also maybe not a well-thought decision, but very intuitive decision. And I ended up in class 10. And so I met 30 people from all around the world. And one of my classmates is a CEO of a rum company in Venezuela. He was kidnapped with his family 4 times and stuff like that. He hired people from gangs, from competing gangs. So within his company, he made the connection between the gangs. And I was like, and my problems are that I deal with a little bit of resistance at KLM. What the fuck?
Yeah.
Another classmate, he was running refugee camps from the United Nations in Syria. So my world opened up. And that was also the moment that I thought, like, I need to do something else. But I was struggling. I don't know what. And then I got a call from a recruiter who asked me, hey, do you want to become the head of innovation for Vueling Airlines in Barcelona? And I was like, no, no way. I'm not going to do it. And then my brother said, why don't you go and talk a little bit? And I said, yeah, we can always talk. So I flew to Barcelona. It was super chaotic. And when I was in the plane back to Amsterdam, I was like, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it. And then one of my friends said, so why are you resisting or whatever? And I don't know exactly the words he said, but that was for me the trigger, like, oh, fuck it, I'm going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But there was one condition that I said to Vueling, like, I don't want to be a permanent contract. So I'm going to found my own company and then you can hire me as a freelance or whatever. And they didn't want to do that. I was like, okay, then we're not going to do it. And they're like, okay, we're going to do it. So that was the start of my company. So everybody always asks me like that it's so courageous that you jumped career. And well, actually, it was easy for me because I had a good job offers. And this assignment was for 2 years. So it was for me an easy landing. I got the courage here at Think because I saw a lot of people around me doing pretty cool stuff. And they also helped me to jump ship, right?
Mm-hmm.
They said, what is holding you back? And the questions that are being asked, I think, are not the superficial questions. It's really reflective and you really learn a lot about yourself.
You mentioned that a lot of people reach out to you and give you praise for what you do, that they relate, that it still triggers you in a way, that you find it sometimes hard to hear that it still happens and there's leadership and employees in the versus and not togetherness. Is it also that you are able to help those people who reach out, for instance, to LinkedIn? Because it's, yeah, you can't save them all. How do you do this?
Yeah, so it gets to me every time, because what I see is there is a lot of talent within people and a lot of willingness, and there is a lot of creativity within people. And then you see organizations not treating people who are slightly different. They are not treated well. So I've experienced that myself a lot. While I also have shown that you can accomplish major results if you do things differently. So it bothers me that organizations don't see that there's a lot of value when people think or act or do or look differently. So when people reach out to me with a story like that, then, well, of course, I remember my own story. But the first advice I give is that if you are different and if you challenge the status quo, what you actually are doing is that you are shaking up the system. And that system gives a lot of people a lot of stability and comfort and security. So the resistance you get is not something personal. It's not against you, but it's because you are shaking up the system and they're, well, the things that give them security. So my first advice is always don't take things personally. I really had to learn that myself too. And then the second advice is, which is related to it, don't make it personal. So whatever someone comes to you or comes at you, don't do it back, because it's not going to help you. And the more sarcastic you get, the more people are going to avoid you, the deeper you are in the shithole. And it's then, a cycle, but not an upgoing cycle, but a vicious cycle downwards.
Yeah.
And if you end up there, it's a dark place.
You are now part of Think Leadership. You embrace it to the fullest. I've read the website and it's for the leadership, which is higher education and such. And one of our guests will also be Henk Oosterling. And he mentioned in an essay and in a conversation with me as well that next leadership should start from the year 4.
Yeah.
You're in with businesses and people who are mid or end of careers. Would there be an ambition for you to teach youngsters? Because I get to know you a little bit. I did my research. I see you in front of me and you're ambitious, but also very empathetic. Would you have such an ambition, or would that maybe in 7 years have grown in a moment?
Yeah, it's fun that you say I don't have children, which was a very conscious choice. I already knew when I was 13 years old, which upset my parents, but that's a different story. They're good with it now. I've written 3 booklets. I'm working on my 4th booklet right now. But everybody always asks me, can you please write a book for children?
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to come. It's not going to be the 4th, but maybe the 5th. And I totally agree that it should start much younger and it should not be for the privileged only. So how do you reach that? For now, I'm aiming for the parents, because a lot of people I talk to, our parents have young children, they all struggle because they see what's happening in the world and they're like, how do I raise my children so that they can think critically, so that they can make their own choices, so that they can survive in this pretty rough world? And I do think that my message connects to that very well, because actually what I say is, be proud of who you are, and if you are different, that's very good, and stay like that. Don't let social media or school form you into something that you're not. So I think we should teach that young children. So who knows what happens?
Yeah.
Maybe we should set up a school for 4-year-olds and learn them totally different kind of skills.
We're sitting next to Artis, and you mentioned, like, not per se my cup of tea because of the animals being caged. And are you, as a rebel, if you call yourself like this, are you free?
It's not an easy to answer question.
We can also...
I think I'm much freer than a lot of people. Am I totally free? I think it's pretty hard for a human in 2024 to be totally free. I'm free in the sense that I don't like stuff. So I don't value a big house. I don't have a car. I don't fancy stuff in my house. I don't care about the latest phone or TV or what kind of stuff. And that's very freeing, because that saves a lot of money. And so my cost of living is pretty low. This is also an advice I would give to a lot of people, is everybody is always focused on getting rich. But if you don't live like very luxurious life, you are also rich, right? Because if I don't make money, I can always work in the supermarket, whatever, and I can live, right? And that's a very free feeling. So in that sense, I feel pretty free.
In another interview, you mentioned your upbringing and what you can and what you can't, and that your brother is the oldest, is the smartest, as they said. And when you said, I want to do mathematics, they said, well, maybe not you.
Yeah.
That's the origin of rebelliousness.
I think my rebelliousness goes back way before that. There's a story when I was 4 years old, and then you have preschool. And here in Holland, you have like this guy at December 5 or 6 comes by and then gives presents. Like in the rest of the world, it's Christmas, but in Holland and Belgium, it's Sinterklaas. And so when I was 4 years old, Sinterklaas came to school and had presents for the children. And the present was a doll for girls and a truck for the boys. And I have been screaming until I got the truck. So I think there was some sort of like rebelliousness, but also a sense of injustice, or I don't know. So I think it started really early on. Yeah, my parents were really protective. Not protective because I played outside, but more like protective in the sense like, oh, take it easy. And if things are too complex, don't do it. Just breathe. And I was like, no, I want to do this. And I was really pushing myself. So I was an example where I was not being pushed by parents. But that also led that they said, when I had to choose my high school, but you don't have to go to the highest education if you just take it easy. But I didn't want to take it easy. And I knew I could do a lot more than I was showing. When I was around 18 or 19 and I had to decide where to go to college, even a couple of years before that, I was like, I want to either study psychology, Dutch language, or mathematics. So I was still struggling. And then I was like, I want to study mathematics. Let's go for it. But everybody said that. Yeah, you cannot do that. It's too hard. And I was like, if it's too hard, I can always quit, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, Well, I made it in 5 years, which was like exceptional. I wanted to study in 6 years, but it was a little bit faster than planned. Yeah, but I graduated. They offered me a PhD. And I was like, no, I don't think a PhD is good for me in mathematics. Who knows, maybe someday. Mm-hmm. But So I made it. And then my parents told me, maybe we always have underestimated you a bit.
Mm-hmm.
They admitted later on, like, we didn't see it, or you hid it, or I don't know.
Now, looking back, and you've had many conversations with others asking you and conversations with yourself, can you point out for others maybe what triggered you to motivate yourself and not say like, oh, other people say it, so then it must be true?
Yeah, I don't know. So when I was 16 years old, I also said to my parents, I came home and I said, I have to tell you something. And they looked at me and I was like, they saw my face was pretty serious. I was like, what is going on? So they sat down and I said, hey, I just want to tell you that I'm not gay. So my parents like, what? We knew that. I said, but I find it strange that people who are gay have to say, hey, I'm gay, and people not don't. So somehow deep down, there's something in me who is always like maybe provoking or thinking about normal stuff, which in my opinion is abnormal. I don't know how you can teach that. I don't know if that's something that was born, how do you say it? That's in my DNA, or that's something that was triggered. I don't know. My mother had an upbringing which was not fair. So she was the fourth child, but the third daughter was at a farmer's place. So they needed boys for the farm. So she was treated fairly. So maybe that's something that I have heard or felt, and maybe that's something that triggered me.
Yeah.
I don't know if I have tips on how to learn this. The only tip is that I can get, if you feel it, just be outspoken.
Right? Mm-hmm.
Don't hold in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's go to some do or die questions.
Yes.
Because there are some topics I would love to talk with you about. And one of those is this one. You can answer whatever you like.
Yeah.
We can talk about it later.
I'm a rebel, so I will.
Because one of those questions, A or B, is purpose or intuition or gut feeling?
I think neither. My answer would be here is curiosity. So everybody always says, you have to find your passion and follow your passion. I think it's very limiting because once you finally have found your passion, if ever, then you're stuck with it and then you cannot change. Because if you say, yeah, this was my passion, but now I have something else, and people are like, what? So that is my problem with passion and intuition or gut feeling. I believe in that too. But it's also fueled by experience. Why would I follow my curiosity more? That's because it brings you to magical places. And you can change over time. a couple of years ago, I started to deep dive into agriculture, which also changed some really fundamental beliefs. But that's because I got curious and I deep dived into it. And then I find something I became passionate about. So for me, it's not passion, it's not gut feeling or intuition, but it's curiosity.
You're a catalyst for change and an innovator for big brands like Lego, IKEA, Miele, Chanel. Like Simon Sinek, he mentions the why, how, what. Why do we do this? And that people start to follow. You get company culture, more togetherness and productivity. But what do you actually see on the work floor when you're asked to come in and help people or businesses who are struggling? How much is the focus actually on the why, how, what?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think most of all, people just want to be heard, respected, valued. That is, I think, the key thing. Most people don't like to work in unethical places. And I say most people because some people do. The ones who are unethical, they want to work also for an unethical boss. I did some research about that. Very interesting. So I think the basics is, are you treated as a human? And then from there, if you are there, if you already have that, but that's in lots of places not... It sounds very logical and very basic, but in lots of places where I come, it's not there, right? So then I think you can start to work on why are we here on Earth, right? And then you see people who work at Patagonia and stuff like that. They are really into passion and I think they can also hire for that. I see so many people, they are just surviving.
Yeah.
They just want to make some money and have their family. And so I understand that Simon Sinek is saying that and that resonates with a lot of people. But if you would see on the work floor, people are already happy when they have an idea and someone listens. Right?
So that's a different core, basically, that you're focusing on.
I also don't like the Generation Z, Y, X or boomers or whatever, because I think this is a core value that is very cross generations. And everybody says, yeah, Gen Z is really focused on this. I meet people from 60 who are also very much into, I want to be heard, I want to be valued, I want to be seen, I want to matter.
Becoming CEO of KLM or continue with Rebella?
Oh, continue with Rebella. No doubt.
Becoming CEO of Patagonia or Netflix or continue with Rebella?
Continue with Rebella.
In a leading function of your choosing at the Obama Foundation or continue with Rebella?
Continue with Rebella.
You work with quite some different brands.
Yes.
Chanel or Lego?
No. Oh, that's that. I'm not going to answer that because there are clients. So I would never say this client is better than that client. Yeah. No, but they both have something special.
Only work from 9 to 5. I hope you're already. But setting your own targets or be boss over your own working hours, but always having a manager managing your targets.
Oh my God, no, I cannot. So this is like a devil's dilemma.
Can you explain why for you?
Yeah, even when I was working at KLM and especially the last part, so the last 5 or 6 years, I was manager of my own time. And I am a really early bird, so I like to start really early, but then in the afternoon
You start quite early. You mentioned how early for the listeners?
So I wake up around 4 or 5. It's not always because I want to, but because I have a cat who has found ways to wake me up. And he is so adorable that I cannot say go away. So
when do you go for sleep?
It depends. So I try to really listen to my body. So sometimes I am really tired and I sleep at 8 or 9. And sometimes it's 10 or 11. Yeah, it depends. And sometimes when during the day, because I manage my own time, I see the cat sleeping on my bed and I'm like, okay, let's do a little nap with the cat for like 30 minutes, power nap, which also helps a lot. You can do that when you are boss over your own time, right? So, but even when I was working in like a pretty hierarchical corporate, I sort of like managed that I could work on weekends, whatever, and then if I didn't feel like Tuesday afternoon work, then I left. I am a strong believer that you should follow your personal energy and your personal inspiration. So I work according to my inspiration. So early mornings, then I write columns or I write pages for my booklets or I just make notes, like things, thoughts, because I know I'm sharp in the morning. I don't want to do email and that kind of stuff or my bookkeeping or because I can better do that in the afternoon. I have always done that. Work according to your inspiration.
Psychology or mathematics?
Oh.
It's the last question. I won't tease you anymore.
It's hard to choose because mathematics learned me not to be afraid of complex stuff. It learned me keep going. There's always a solution. If path A is not working, then path B and C. So these lessons are very helpful to me today. However, I'm not sure if I use a lot of mathematical formulas, whatever, in my day-to-day jobs or assignments. And psychology is we are surrounded by people and it's all about people. If I really have to choose, it's more, I think, psychology than the mathematics. But mathematics brought me a lot.
You worked for 16 years at KLM.
Yes.
And I never worked at such a large company. And it has like...
There are 35,000.
Yeah.
Yes.
So let's dive into a little bit when people are a rebel and they are stuck in their position. Can you tell people how many times you created your own job?
Yeah, 4 or 5 times.
Yeah.
And that's quite exceptional in such a hierarchical organization. So at KLM, I always joke that you see how important someone is because you see they have a uniform. And the more stripes on the uniform, the more important they are. Such a hierarchical company. And then still, I survived as a rebel. Yeah, what often happened is I learned pretty early on that if you have a job, make sure you do whatever you are supposed to do, do it well. So they can never say, hey, you're not doing your job. So I always had like my job sort of like under control. And then I started to get bored a little bit and I looked around and I was like, oh, we can do this and we can do that. And I started to work on things. And then in the beginning, everybody was like, oh my God, and the hassle. And then they were like, maybe there's something in that. And then that became my new job. And then it started all over again. I started to get bored and I started to do things. And then that became my new job. So this happened sort of like four or five times.
How do you do it? Create your own job?
I think the first time happened, I was working at headquarters and I was part of a team with only mathematicians or people who studied econometrics. And our job was we got an easy question and then we had to come up with an answer with a mathematical model. The good thing of that job was that I worked all over KLM. So I had a pretty broad view of the entire company. When I was studying mathematics, I learned a lot about Lean and Six Sigma. So I had that in my backpack.
Can you explain a little bit what that is?
Lean is get rid of all the bureaucracy in your organization. And Six Sigma is use data to improve your processes. This was pretty, popular. Like 20 years ago. And I had that in my backpack. I walked around in engineering and maintenance, which is like a division of KLM, 5,000 or 6,000 people, which is like a large company in a company. And I thought, I think they can benefit really well from Lean and Six Sigma. So I bumped into a guy who was managing the relationship between KLM and Boeing and KLM and GE. Boeing was really known for Lean and GE was really known for Six Sigma. And we connected on the topic. And we said, okay, let's write a plan. Because he was also like, yeah, we need to do something like that. So we wrote a plan. We presented it to the executive vice president of engineering maintenance. And he was like, yeah, let's do it. I was like, oh, shit. Let's do it. But I was still like part of the team at headquarters. But half of the time I was already working at engineering and maintenance. And then I managed that I could make the transfer. And then, well, that was the first time that I created my new job. And it's funny because nowadays it's still a department within KLM Engineering and Maintenance. There are still a Lean Six Sigma team over there. So
it's quite impressive.
Yeah.
Good to hear.
Yeah. And I'm still connected to the people who work there. So that was the first time.
You had some amazing projects. Also the laundry, if I'm correct.
Yeah.
Can you tell a little bit about this up till the moment that you had a warehouse that you wanted to transform, but it didn't really help? Because it's fascinating to see how you internally in a company manage to innovate and think different. Because I think that's also one of my aims with the podcast is not to tell people you should do this or that, but just
have
different, different perspectives.
Around 2010, something like that, I moved to a new job within KLM, which was at ground operations. So that's all the work or all the processes at Schiphol Airport. And I was responsible for catering and board supplies. So all the logistics around catering and board supplies.
Did you choose it or created this job?
No. This was actually, I didn't create. So how did I end up here? I was leading a team of 250 mechanics at...
the beginning of your 30s even.
Yeah, it was my first managerial job.
Gee.
250 guys. I think there were like maybe three or four women, which were like the secretary and some staff. The rest were all guys. They were all at least 10 years older, at least. And I was leading the components repair shop for the avionics. So it's like all the components in the cockpit and stuff like that. The black boxes. And my manager at that time told me things that were not true. And if you know me by now a little bit, one of the things I really value is honesty and justice. So he was also treating the employees not well. I'm leading up to the laundry, right? So what happened here is, was drinking from a fire hose, right? My first leadership role, I needed a mentor, but I was left alone. And then in a very rocky situation, one of my direct reports had been at home, reportedly sick for more than 10 years. So I was like, what's going on here? So I asked him to come to the office to meet me and just to get to know each other because I was his new manager. And the first couple of weeks, he was like, hey, there's attention. That's nice. But then he started to understand that I wanted him to get back to work. So he couldn't smoke weed anymore at home. So he started to threaten me, which was tough. So for 2 years, I really built up like a case so we could say goodbye to him in the end. I gave him all the opportunities to come back to either the same place or maybe other place. If you have a company of 35,000 employees, there is always a place where you can land. But he obviously didn't want that. So that was really tough. So I had like an employee threatening me. I had a boss who was not supporting me, who gave me... maybe that was, I think, the most thing that got to me. He didn't treat the employees well. This was a pivotal moment for me, right? So I was like, I don't think I want to climb the corporate ladder. I just want to do cool stuff. I know I can lead large teams and all the other people really loved the way I lead it after a while, because in the beginning they said, a woman as a boss, we don't want that. So I had to conquer that too, really. But then I decided after 2 years, like, I'm not sure if I want to do these kind of leadership roles. More, I just want to do cool stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe this is also why I was responding to CEO of whatever company versus proceeding with Vella. I think I'm much better in the role I'm right now. But that also made me look around, like, okay, what could be my next job? And I found this open position for a manager or director of the logistics of catering and board supply. Different division, operation, Schiphol, which was like a horizontal step within KLM and in large corporates, that's strange if you do that. But for me, it was like, yeah, that was really nice. Nice team. So then it started. So, okay, a couple of months, I had everything under control. And I was like, okay, I also do the laundry. I was also responsible for the laundry of pillows, blankets, 5 million a year. So that's a huge volume.
This has to do with the airplanes that are landing and that
needs
to
be. Yeah. So this is for all the planes that fly intercontinental,
mm-hmm.
They have blankets because people sleep at nights and they have pillows. So KLM provides that on board. So it also has to be cleaned, right? Although my responsibility was sort of like a logistic process at Schiphol Airport, I also had sort of like this side process of doing the laundry of that stuff, okay, which was sort of like strange. So after a couple of months, I was like, but it's strange that we do this laundry and we do it at a certain place. And then we have KLM uniforms because our cabin crew, pilots, but also the mechanics, they all have like overalls, uniforms, and they all have different contracts, right? And I was like, that's strange. And they all had different logistic processes. And I was like, that could be optimized, right? And with lean in my backpack, I was like, oh, we can lean this process. So I started to work on that. And my boss was like, all the hassle, because at KLM, you have ground operations, was the division I was working in. But the pilots is a different division. The cabin crew is a different division. Engineering and maintenance is a different division. Then you have purchasing, which is also a different ballgame. And my manager was like, oh my God, and all those people. And KLM is, at least at that time, was not normal or it was not standard to collaborate across divisions for the greater good, right? Everybody was going for their own KPIs. But I was like, no, we need to improve. So I started the project, or I started to work on it. And then we found a space at Schiphol Noord, which is close to center, where is a whole building owned by KLM. Half of it was empty. And I was like, okay, let's build a laundry over there. So we started to create a business case, and it was a really good business case. Somehow I got a lot of people on board. So I got purchasing on board. I got also real estate on board. I got catering on board because of the catering linen. And then all the other divisions, somehow they sort of like started to collaborate. So we created a business case and I got an approval of the business case. I don't know how we managed, but the business case also had like a 10-year contract with the laundry party, which was exceptional. I still have an email of the COO who said, 10 years, we're never going to do it. I kept it because it was Peter Elbers who wrote that. We didn't know each other back then. So we managed to get a go. At the day that we had to tear off one of the walls to get the laundry machines in, because they're huge machines and they couldn't get in the building only if we tear down a wall. And at that very moment, I think the VP of purchasing called me and he said, we have to stop. The board of directors want something else with the building. We cannot do the laundry there.
Oh, no.
And I said, well, we have a good case. I'm more than happy to explain it to the board. And everybody's like, no, I'm not, no. And I said, I can do it. No problem. If you don't, all the managers above, and because I was somewhere deep down in the organization, I said, no problem. I can explain. So everybody was like, And somehow, I don't know what happened, but the idea of the board of directors vanished. They had a new idea or whatever. So the fuss was all about nothing. And we could continue. Yeah, and the laundry is still working because the way we worked, and I taught them how to work in a lean way. They also have now a laundry in Germany and they do all the work for Lufthansa. So they also were able to grow. And it's a very social place because they work with people with disabilities. And they're very sustainability oriented. So it's also very nice to, well, 10 years ago already have such a social or sustainable innovation. Mm-hmm. It's hip and happening now, but 10 years ago we also had a project like that.
What an accomplishment.
Yeah.
So, but Peter knows you now quite well.
Peter knows me, yes. But that was not because of this. That was because of what came after that.
You sent an email.
There was something in between that. I don't know if we have time, because I can talk about this for hours.
but I think it's quite nice to hear that you being very proactive.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing, that you send an email. And how much do you still value that you wrote an email with Peter, please free me up?
I'm going to do cool stuff for you. What happened here is there is a project in between, because I think that was pivotal. And that was also the reason why he said yes. So what happened is, I was building this laundry place and there was a new executive vice president for ground operations in that time. So he wanted to get to know everybody who was managing a process at Schiphol Airport. The secretary called me and she said, hey, Adrian wants to meet you and he wants to see your process. And I said, okay, I'm going to bring him to Schiphol Noord. So the secretary is at Schiphol Noord. Why the hell? We need to be at Schiphol Center. He said, no, I'm doing something interesting there. So I took him to Schiphol Noord and he was like, whoa, what's going on here? And he really liked it. I think he was triggered. So 2 weeks later, he asked me to drink coffee with him. And he said, when I said yes to this new position, that was under one condition. The board of directors asked me to improve the turnaround processes of aircraft. And a turnaround process of an aircraft is whenever it lands, when the plane lands, it needs to be prepared to take off again. So lots of processes going on because luggage need to get out and in, passengers in, out, catering in, out, fuel. So I think about 14 processes going on to prepare a plane to fly again. And the time on ground, what this time is called turnaround time. Time on ground, a plane needs to be in the air, right? Then it makes money, not when it's on the air ground. So this guy said to me, yeah, there has been a deadlock for years. So ground operations needs to shorten these turnaround times, but it costs a lot of money. So that's the reason why we haven't been doing it. And commercial said, we don't want to share how much it will benefit. So we're in a sort of that deadlock. And this guy asked me, how would you do this? And I said, oh, I know how,
but we're going to do it my way. And he was like, okay. We didn't know each other, but he saw me building this laundry and he was like, okay. I think he was happy that someone was enthusiastic because I think everybody else was like, oh, no, don't go there. And there was finally someone naively enough to say, yeah, I'm going to do it. So I took ownership of that. And this was a whole different ballgame than the laundry because this is the core of an airline. Because you have the pilots, you have the cabin crew, you have engineering and maintenance, you have all these operational processes. So this guy was my sponsor. He was the executive VP of ground operations. We took the smallest aircraft, which was City Hopper. So City Hopper is also a separate division within KLM. So we needed to have the guy leading that was also a sponsor. So I had two sponsors.
What does a sponsor do for you?
I said to them, your role is really easy. I said, I want to know what is my garden. So tell me the limitations, because I don't want to end up coming up with ideas and that you're going to say, no, but this cannot be done. So I want to know what my limitations are upfront. So that's what I want to hear from you. And then it's easy. I want people who work in this process, no managers allowed, and I want to free them up for 4 days. And we're going to put them in a room. And what you have to do is in the morning, you come, you inspire the team, you say what the limitations are. You say good luck, and on day 4, you come back and you say yes to every suggestion they do. That's it. And they were like, I said, but if you give me the limitations, you won't be surprised. And if you share the limitations to the people, they also know what, well, you manage their expectations, right? And it could be that they have ideas that go beyond, but they also know that they can get a no then. So this is the game. Oh, and by the way, I don't want to have a specific goal. No target. So the turnaround time was 50 minutes, 50. And for years they said it needs to go to 40. And I said, if you say that, I'm not going to do it. Because one, it can be limiting. Maybe the outcome could be better. Or maybe it's impossible. But then you have a good story why it's impossible. So no specific goal. This was so not KLM approach. So they said, okay. So I did a lot of preparations. I got my team ready. There's a long story, but it leads up to all the rest. So I think that the week was in April, mid-April or something like that. We would start on Monday and I got a call on Thursday or Friday prior from the secretary of one of the two sponsors. And the secretary said, oh, the sponsor cannot join the report out, but no worries, we have someone who can replace him from the team. And my response was, okay, that's a pity he cannot join. Replacement is okay, but I'm not doing replacement down. So if he cannot be there, then he needs to be replaced by the boss. Or we're just going to cancel the session. So the secretary was quiet. I'll discuss it. So I was also like, oh my God, what did I just do? I called the other sponsor and I said to him, this is what's happening. And I said, I mean it. I'm going to cancel it. And he was like, I think he was smiling a little bit. He said, Simone, I will call you back in a couple of minutes. So he called me minutes later and he said, I called my boss, which was the COO, which is also the boss of the other sponsor. He likes this. He freed up his agenda. He will be there. Okay, cool. And then I got a call from the other secretary who also learned that the CEO was going to join. And she said, he's going to be there too. But then the CEO was already in and he was like, I'm going to be there. So he was excited. So we did the week. And then Thursday afternoon around 4, the report out was there. In the morning, I said to the team, I hadn't said before, I said, this afternoon we're going to do a report out. I'm not going to present. You are going to present. And imagine, these people are loading luggage and that kind of stuff. So they're like, what? So, oh, by the way, the CEO will come to listen. And because the CEO comes, a lot of managers also wanted to join. So it's going to be a little bit busy. And they're like, oh, okay. So we had a good day. We prepared the presentation. It was 4 o'clock. The report out was about to start. The CEO comes with his car and his driver or whatever. And then the two sponsors too. And they wanted to enter the room, which was filled with people. And I said, oh, just 1 minute. If you want to ask questions, that's fine. But please be constructive. These people, they're pretty nervous and they're not used to these kind of stuff.
So take that a little bit into account. And the CEO looked at me with big eyes and he was like, who are you? And I said, hey, I'm Simone. I am arranging a little bit some stuff. And I walked away. And then it started. So the team started. I introduced the team and then the team took over. So the team, small team, had worked on a design that the turnaround time could go back from 50 to 20 minutes. So the CEO looked at me like, what the hell is going on here? And then we said, but we have limitations. So if you want to go for 20 minutes, a lot of these limitations that we got, they're broken or we need to go beyond them. So what is more realistic is this design. So another team presented 35 minutes. And everybody was like relieved. Oh, it's not 20 minutes, it's 35 minutes. Ah, and we had 14 action plans and we said, hey, we're going to do it like this. And when some questions came, you saw the cleaning guy struggle a little bit with his answer. Then the pilot joined. He explained that there was a real good team and they had like thought about every detail. So we were running a little bit out of time. So I walked to the CEO and I said, do I need to ask them to speed up? Because I know you have another appointment. He said, no, I'm going to be late there. I want to hear this and it's fine. So, okay. So by the end, the team said, we're going to do this in 35 minutes. There was someone from network who could do the calculations. He said, we're going to free up a whole plane for this. So it saves that. It also saved a lot more of pilot time and all a lot of efficiency stuff. Oh, and by the way, we're going to implement it in the next schedule, which is in 3 months. And we don't need any investments. And the CEO looked at us, which was Peter Albers back then. He took the word and he gave a lot of compliments to the team. And he said to all the managers that wanted to, the CEO is there and I want to meet the CEO. He said, hey, everybody, have you listened? And you have heard the story here. We're going to do it exactly as this team says. So make sure it happens. And team, if you run into something, come to me and we'll fix it. And then he left. And everybody was like, whoa, we're going to do it. Yeah. The day after at 7 a.m, I got an email from the CEO like, wow, and this is the way to do it. And this was how I got to know Peter Albers. So from then on, when there was like something, a deadlock or a tough issue, he always called me like, hey, Simone, can you help me? Which put me in a lot of difficult positions because I had a normal job and I transitioned already to a different role. And there I had a leader who was, we were not the best friends. So that we had lots of arguments about this because the CEO called me to do work. And then my boss said, but you have to work for me. And I'm like, okay.
Did you ever had talks with Peter about this? Like, hey, thank you, but maybe not thank you? Because how could other people do this? Because you go from an ultimate high, sort of say, to an whoa.
So what happened to me is that year with this accomplishment, I did that on the side. So it was not in my target. You feel it coming, right? It was not in my targets. By the end of the year, I got my, my performance review. So my manager said, well, you scored like great, a little bit better, but good. So I had like a good performance review. And I was like, fuck me. Did you see what I also did next to my normal job? Yeah, but we didn't agree on that. So it's not in the target review form. So we're not going to take that into account. So I doubted, should I call Peter Albers and say that this is happening? And I was like, I'm not going to bother the CEO with my performance review. Right? So I didn't do that.
Regret?
No. It's fine.
Yeah.
It's, for me, it's not about money. It's more so...
It's not about money. And like many others, I'm the same.
Yeah.
But it does a lot with your motivation. And basically, you're a person who goes all in.
Yeah.
That's why you can make changes.
Yeah.
But if then someone is like injustice, what you say.
Yeah.
Then the whole moral compass starts to spin. And then you're like, yeah, but sorry, if why?
Yeah.
Then you have the context. You're in the deadlock.
Yeah.
It's not about money. But what is it that you then, is it because you're not a quitter?
Yeah.
Up to expectations from yourself or others, moving around in the company. What did you do and why? Because you could free up yourself and continue to do stuff that you actually...
I basically did, right? Because this was 2012, 2013. And then Peter Elvers became the CEO in 2014. And then I wrote him an email. Hey, Peter, free me up. We're going to do cool stuff. And he said yes. So that's how I created. And that's why the reason why Peter said yes. If I would be a random person, not with this track record, he probably would have said no, of course not.
So maybe it's irrelevant to question this even, but I still like to, that if he wasn't CEO and there was not that email, you were still with the same, how would have...
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. What if? I don't know. I think it kept me going for...
Sorry that I interrupted. Maybe it's not per se about you, but about others who are actually in this and are listening and saying, like, maybe in the future something changes, but then the change doesn't come.
I think it goes back to two questions you asked before. One is, do you feel free? Which is related to expectations. And the other one is, I told the story that in 2010, I decided I want to do cool stuff with all the stuff that happened with my boss and with the threatening. And there I really changed from, I don't want to climb the corporate ladder, whatever. I just want to do cool stuff. And I'm happy with that. So I couldn't bother what others told me about, hey, you should say something about your performance review. I was like, look at the result we created. Look at the team. Because all the people who were part of this project, they outgrown themselves. And that was for me the satisfaction that I got from it. I already knew that the manager I had in that time was very different from me. So I didn't expect him to change. In hindsight, I understand why he reacted like that. Maybe I should have done things a little bit different. I didn't. I learned a lot from it. Would I do the same again? Yes, because I think that's the rebel. What would I say to people who are in these kind of positions? You can always create your own environment, even if you work in such a large environment. Make sure what you do well, because I made sure that the team I managed back then was going well. So my manager then could not say, I'm going to kick you out because you are underperforming. I was doing well. That he became jealous because I did something else. I'm bigger and I had all the connections in the company. I could see that as his problem and not mine. Yeah. I think you can take much more ownership of your own job, of your own things than you think.
I think it's also quite interesting to learn about these sponsorships and maybe now for leaders wherever, how important it is to listen.
Yeah.
And to back up, give freedom, and then actually to see what people like rebels
could do. But this is also my frustration. My business today is this, right? Mm. So I have sort of like an impossible business model. Because what I want to accomplish is to unleash rebel talent. And most leaders think of rebels as, oh my God, that's trouble. And the last thing I want to do is unleash trouble in my organization. Mm-hmm. So why do people hire me? Most leaders are like, oh, they need to be far away from me because we don't want rebels in our organization. Well, I think if you create the right context, magic happens. But how do you sell that? And that's for me also a big struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And this is also why I am super happy to work now with Pascal, who is like a professor at Nijrode, who sees the same, right? He sees all these leaders. He does a lot of research on rebellious behavior. And he also sees like you can accomplish a lot, but it requires leaders to be a bit different.
No. And is it also, for instance, if you... Because I know that you're quite acquainted with Netflix, Aaron Meyer's book about the cultures. Probably also the presentation deck they once made. What kind of impact does such a thing do for you, seeing that such a company goes completely different as an approach?
Yeah.
Is it something you carry by heart and give as examples to leaders? Because it downloaded 17 million times, but I still meet a lot of people who have no idea.
Yeah, I once tried to create a deck like that when I was working, for instance, for Vueling. I was head of innovation. And for me, innovation is not only about technological stuff or digital, but it's also very much about the human side. So you have to create the right culture. So I think I once started to translate
a Netflix deck for Vueling, like how would it look like for Vueling? And I think I also tried it for KLM. I don't know. I don't have the answer why so many companies try to stay far away from that.
Mm-hmm. Big tip from both of us. Check it.
Yeah.
It's quite old already.
So. Yeah, but it's so still very valid.
Very, yeah. If we ask like why are rebels maybe not heard or overlooked, but yeah, I think mostly ignored. Because of what you also mentioned, like, yeah, if you go stand on the other side, you're running a business.
Yeah.
And you were a manager of a 250. Sorry, but I have so many other stuff to do with just running a daily business, paying the salary.
Yeah.
What can others learn from this?
I had the conversation with one of my clients about this yesterday. And I said, if you have a problem, I know the firefighting mindset. But if you firefight the same problem every day, there might be something structurally going on. And if you solve that, you free up a lot of time, right? I don't understand why leaders don't see that, right? They don't take the time just to breathe a little bit and to say, okay, we're going to fix some things structurally. So we don't have to firefight all the time. But they keep going on in the loop. So if I could change one thing from when I was leading that team of 250 mechanics, my agenda was overloaded with meetings. I would never do that again. I would, and that's also what I learned here, I think, is maybe block one morning or two mornings or an entire day a week. Block it to think, to reflect, and take time for that because it's super important. And most of my clients I work with today, they are still having these super full agendas. But as a leader, I think the only thing to get out of the shit is to take a step back.
Taking a step aside, I would love to hear your stories about Taylor Swift and Agassi.
So when I'm on stage in a keynote or when I do a rebel workshop, one of the themes I always touch upon is slow down to go fast. And Andre Agassi's story is a really nice one. And I bumped into that a couple of years ago and I didn't know. Andre Agassi and Boris Becker played against each other. And the first couple of times, Andre Agassi always lost. Always. And what I find interesting is what Agassi did. He didn't go back on the course and train even more, but he slowed down. So he sat behind the TV and he started to watch a lot of Boris Becker playing tennis. And after a lot of hours, he discovered something. And he discovered that every time Boris Becker had to play service, he did something with his tongue. So he stuck his tongue out in the direction that he was going to serve. And Agassi saw that and he discovered that. But I think the next thing was most crucial is Agassi didn't use that every time. Because if he would apply this knowledge every time, Boris Becker would have noticed within an instant and he would have stopped. So Agassi also held back and only used his knowledge very strategically and at the moments that he could break a game or a match. And ever since he got that insight, he almost won every match with Boris Becker. And the fun story here is that I think in 2019 or so, they visited each other. And I think Agassi went to Germany to go to the beer fest or whatever. They had beers together. And this is where Agassi told Boris Becker, "Hey, did you know?" And Becker said, "I had no clue." And he always said to his wife, I don't know which wife because he had many, I think. But Becker always said to his wife, "It's somehow it feels like Andre Agassi can read my mind." But he could not read his mind, but his tongue. But it's slowing down to be able to observe, right? And I think crucial, if I would ever go back in a busy leadership position, for me, blocking time would be holy. To observe, to reflect, and to see how to break the system or to break things rather than firefight. Yeah, and Taylor Swift. There's a lot to say. I didn't like Taylor Swift at all. I was not interested in her music. But I think she's a really fascinated person. And the more I read about her, the more research I do about her, the more I adore her. So I totally understand the hype around her. If I listen at her music, I don't think that is the best ever. But yeah, she really stays true to herself. And she has very interesting ways to engage with her audience. A lot to learn from her.
Quite fascinating. But maybe not per se about Taylor Swift herself, as she's unique, but more on the fact that people are passionate about something or they have a certain drive, gut feeling, however you want to call it. They're in front of everyone, but then all of a sudden they're pushed by public opinion and such, and or by problems. Do you have this yourself as well, because you see problems and you chase it, but do you also have times that you're basically pushed and that you're like, okay, then, and then it accelerates in a way that you're...
Well, it's, if I look back at my KLM career, it's every project I started, there was pushback. I think there's a saying, like, I'm not sure if Mandela or Gandhi, so it said, first they laugh at you, then they try to stop you, and then everybody cheers you or something like that. With all the projects I did, everybody was like, why are you doing that? And then in the end, when you become successful, everybody wants to be part of it. Hopefully with my business as being rebel. But yeah, and not everybody likes the rebel theme. If I look at social media, I also lose a lot of followers because I think I might be too outspoken sometimes or too, I don't know,
or not. That's basically almost the problem.
Yeah.
That it's so conservative or...
Yeah. Yeah, maybe I'm not too outspoken because I really try to connect and not to polarize. But if you want to become pop, well, you have to be negative and you have to be very outspoken. Okay. And Sander Schimmelpenning did a nice research about that. And I don't want to be that. I don't want to be one person more who is polarizing this world. But I do think I look different at the world. And so I may sometimes say like, hey, I think passion is highly overrated. And then people who strongly believe in that are like, oh, let's cancel her because I know it's not what I believe. So maybe because I think radically different. So I do have sort of like a feeling that maybe hopefully with the rebel theme that it starts to grow a little bit.
One of my last questions, you entered the creative industries and you started working with LEGO and Chanel. What kind of learnings did you get from the people and vice versa? What did they learn from you?
Yeah, Chanel is a nice example because what happened there is I was head of innovation for Vueling Airlines, but didn't have a permanent contract. So I was hired. So I was also free to do things on the side. Although it was like more than a full-time job. I lived in Barcelona, but I also lived in Amsterdam. And then the CIO of Chanel came to me and asked if I wanted to help him too. I was like, but I have quite a busy life. And then we had a nice conversation and we said, okay, Paris is in between Amsterdam and Barcelona. Okay, let's see how we can work it out. That was such a total mindfuck for me because I was in the airline industry and especially at Vueling, which is a low cost. It's all about selling as much as you can for the lowest price. And then Chanel was like, okay, if you sell too much, prices go up. If you go to a Chanel boutique, you cannot buy more than one bag in 3 months. And I was like, what? So I had never thought about that. And I'm not a Chanel person, as you can see. So for me, we opened like, okay, you can approach things differently. But what also happened is I was working on an innovation at Vueling Airlines and I said to Chanel, I think you can also benefit from this technology, what we're doing. So we were tracing luggage with bag trackers and Chanel has a lot of stuff in the boutiques. And I said, maybe you can use these trackers to see where the products are in the storage of the store. So back end, you can leverage no matter which industry you're in, Chanel could learn from Vueling. Right? So that was also eye-opening for them. For me, Chanel, I was not really into their products, right? Because that's a protective world. But for me, the craftsmanship, but also they don't brag a lot about how sustainable they are and the products they use. Lots of the products are locally produced. It was a very different kind of way on how to position yourself. That was interesting for me.
And LEGO?
It's not a client that I work for a lot. The culture is very different. So they're like very playful and it's really ingrained in their culture already. So
and you, like me, were quite triggered by maybe the book or their success and downfall and getting up again.
Yeah.
I found it fascinating.
What for me was most pivotal was in 2017 because they almost went bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
It went really well. And then in 2017, they had rocky times again. And I didn't know this. So I deep dived into that. And what they did was, and this was all about leadership. They said, okay, how are we going to change all these things? Instead of that, leadership said, we're going to do this and we're going to hire an expensive consultant and they're going to tell us. They created a board of employees and they created the whole change program. And I was like, that is interesting.
Yeah.
So this is still a column on the shelf. So hopefully.
I'm very much looking forward to it. Yeah. I read the book brick by brick. I loved it. Do you have more ideas to go into the creative industries? As in, creative thinking for innovation is super important.
Yeah.
For yourself, for youngsters. Do you see, for instance, with education, for instance, art school?
Yeah.
Or different ways that you're like, hey, now that this rebelliousness is finally getting off the ground and people are actually seeing the benefit of it.
Yeah.
What are the potentials and thoughts? You're a little bit creative yourself, as in the programs like Photoshop and InDesign.
I'm super creative.
Yeah.
Well, it's maybe strange to say about yourself, but I...
Well, if you come from the corporate world, you work at KLM, but you also did Photoshop, InDesign. Yeah. That's stuff people don't expect. I didn't expect you...
No, so every summer I took a week off and then I did a summer course at the University of Amsterdam. No, that's because I just like to create. I also have made my own furniture at home and stuff like that. So I like to create. And this is also why my books are different. It's not text. It's like lots of images. And yeah, so I'm already half in the creative industry, right? No, I think what would happen sooner is that I bring creativity to the non-creative world rather than I step really into the creative world. Because I think organizations need more creativity. They should use more art. They should use more, I don't know, nature for inspiration. They should open their windows, because I think the answers for all their problems are already out there, but they are not within reach. They are in different kind of areas.
Art, what does it mean to you?
With art, I think several things happen. Is you can create things that may seem impossible, right? But with art, you are able to create new worlds that might then be possible to create in real life. I think art also teaches you how to deal with ambiguity, because sometimes if you look at art and you don't understand it, hopefully you get curious or you learn to get through that feeling of uncomfortability and try to make sense of it, right? And if you start to learn to feel more comfortable with that uncomfortable feeling, that's, I think, you should learn to survive in the corporate world, because nothing is certain. And the only thing, I think this is the most important lesson I can teach people, is get comfortable with feeling uncomfortable. And I think art can help a lot with that. Art is also one of the things I do, I help some of my clients with. It's not only about rebelliousness, it's also about creating a future customer strategy or creating a future. And I always envision that. So it's never in words. And that's also kind of art, right?
Thank you. And I fully believe in what you do and what you stand for. Thank you.
Yeah, and thanks for your great questions. Because every time it also teaches me something about myself. Well, and if people have more questions, they can always reach out to me. And subscribe to the Dr. Rebel newsletter,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely. Oh, yes. Thank you. That was my conversation with Simone van Neerwe, a masterclass in embracing discomfort, questioning the rules, and thriving as an outsider. Simone reminded us that rebellion isn't about being loud, it's about being deliberate. From her journey in KLM to coaching world-class brands, she has shown that the best ideas come from those who dare to challenge the status quo. She also highlighted the importance of slowing down, following curiosity over passion, and learning to take resistance as a sign that you're on the right path. If you've ever felt like you don't fit into a system, this episode is proof that you don't have to. You can change it instead. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to click the follow button, rate the podcast, subscribe to the newsletter, and spread the word, so we can continue to grow the Don't Waste Eye podcast. And remember, everyone struggles, and that's okay. But standing still prevents you from growing and reaching your potential. Keep moving forward, because the better you become, the more you'll inspire others. Don't waste your time, don't waste your eye.